All right, so I'm going to talk this afternoon about some work I've been doing recently with Peter Cargill of Imperial and St Andrews. And this work grew out of our efforts, along with Jim Klimchuk, to update the Ebtail model. And it's been pretty nice to see a couple of presentations this morning who have actually made use of this model. So in developing a 0D model, you really have to think very, very carefully about what field-aligned physics are important in the corona and lower down into the transition region as well. And we really put a good deal of effort into trying to get this right. And one of the ways in which we did this was we used a 1D model to actually benchmark the 0D model to try and get as good agreement for all of the phases of evolution of the loop as we possibly could. And along the way, we made one or two interesting observations, and out of those, this work that Peter and I did then grew. So we're going to talk about what happens when you under-resolve regions of the sun's atmosphere in numerical models, okay? What consequences there are for the actual physics that you think you're modeling. So we have a couple of questions that we want to answer. The first question is, very simply, what are the consequences of under-resolving the sun's atmosphere in numerical models when you're trying to study coronal heating, okay? And the second question is, what resolution can we get away with for particular regimes? So I don't just want to leave you with a horror story of, oh, if you under-resolve the atmosphere, then it's all going to go dreadfully wrong. I want to actually offer some practical advice as well about what you need to aim for if you want to model certain field-aligned physics in particular regimes. Okay. Now, I'd also like to be able to say what can actually be done to help overcome some of these difficulties, but I have 12-ish minutes and time's ticking by, so I'm not going to talk about that. I'm just going to focus on the first two questions, but this work has been published. It's there in AppJ, so if you want to have a look at the third question, then, you know, do read the paper or come and grab me. I'm here most of the week. All right, so let's get on with it. So we're interested in understanding and quantifying, which is a very important word in this case, what the consequences of inadequately resolving your regions of your numerical models are, okay? And what conditions can you claim that your models are physically realistic? And by physically realistic in this case, I mean, can you be reasonably sure that you're actually modeling the physics that you think you're modeling, okay? The physics that you've actually put into your model, all right? So we're going to be dealing with heating the corona in situ in this case, okay? Just for the moment, I'm not terribly interested in whether heating's low down or high up or wherever else it is. But when you put energy into the corona, then the first thing that happens is it gets hotter, obviously, okay? And the temperature gradient of the lower atmosphere steepens because the corona wants to get rid of all this excess energy. Okay, you've just dumped a load of energy in. The first thing the corona does is, I want to get rid of this immediately. Okay, so steep temperature gradients develop, and the system tries to get rid of it, get back to its sort of minimum energy configuration. Okay, so let's do a quick example of the kind of challenges that models are facing. So we're going to take a 4 million degree active region loop just in hydrostatic equilibrium, and this is actually a pretty benign case. Hydrostatic equilibrium is actually pretty easy to deal with in numerical models. It's when you get really hot under dense loops is when difficulties can start arising. But anyway, as we know, the corona gets hot, wants to conduct away all this energy, thermal conduction, okay? Now, thermal conduction in the classical approximation scales as the temperature to the power of 5/2. So it's very strongly nonlinear. Now, in the corona, because it's hot, then a very shallow gradient is really sufficient to get rid of all of this excess energy. Okay, you don't need steep temperature gradients. And you can come up with a rough estimate of this just from the Spitzer heat flux equation, and you find out that in the corona, given a coronal temperature and a typical heat flux, you need the temperature scale length, which is this quantity here, is a few thousand kilometers, okay? So if you want to resolve that, grid cells of a few hundred kilometers are adequate, okay? You just need your grid cells to be smaller than your temperature scale length, and you should be fine. Now, if we go down to the transition region, the temperature drops, but all that heat flux is still coming through, so the only thing that can happen is the temperature gradient has to steepen to be able to deal with it. And in this case, for our reasonably benign 4 million degree loop, then we find the temperature scale length can drop down to a few thousand meters, okay? So we're talking kilometers in the transition region, and this means you need grid cells of order kilometers, maybe, in order to be able to handle this heat flux. And in the quiet sun, of course, these values aren't so extreme. Temperatures are lower, so your grid cells can be commensurately larger and so forth. But in flares, of course, the situation is vastly more extreme than this, and we have 10, 20, 30 million degree temperatures to deal with, okay, with commensurately much more stringent conditions on the sort of structures that you have to resolve. And we find, for instance, in some of the flare models that we run, you have to get down to literally meter resolution in order to be able to support the heat flux that's coming barreling in from the corona down through the transition region. Okay. All right. Now, one of the problems with small grid cells is small time steps. Okay. So this little formula here allows you to estimate the time that it takes for a thermal conduction front to propagate a grid cell. And this is the time step that you need to capture in your models if you want everything to either be accurate and or stable. So you can see it depends on the square of the grid cell width. Smaller grid cells equals smaller time steps, okay? So if you have an explicit code, then in order to keep your solution stable, then you have to step on at least this time step, all right? And usually you have to stick a safety factor in there as well, depending on how robust your numerical algorithm is. Now, if you have an implicit code, then you're somewhat freed from this constraint. You can step on timescales that are larger than this estimate. But then, of course, your code doesn't resolve the principal timescale of the system, okay? So implicit codes are great for slowly evolving to an equilibrium. They're not so great for capturing the fast dynamics that, say, might take place in a flare or some sort of violent active region heating. And we found in our studies that the time step can vary between maybe a tenth of a second under pretty quiet conditions down to less than 10^-7 seconds in flares, okay? All right, so we can't put tiny grid cells everywhere in our dynamical, on our grid, because that just becomes unmanageable and also unnecessary in some regions. So there's three things we can do. Use fixed non-uniform grids and hope that the gradients that you need to resolve don't venture too far from where they start. That usually turns out never to be the case. You can use a stretching algorithm, so you can have high resolution where you need it, and it can move with the gradient, but it has the advantage of keeping the number of grid cells constant, but you usually only get one region of high resolution, okay, usually in the vertical direction. Or you can do the most desirable thing, which is have a fully adaptive grid that increases the density of grid cells wherever they're needed, so you can resolve multiple steep gradients at a time. So for instance, if you look at thermal non-equilibrium, where you get a condensation forming in the corona and the thing cools down to chromospheric temperatures, you end up with four transition regions, basically, in your solution, okay? And with a proper adaptive grid, you can resolve all four of them properly. So we do the latter. So what we did is we ran a whole bunch of numerical experiments where we just dumped a load of energy into the corona, and for different lengths of loop, so short loops, longer loops, we use different amounts of energy, from sort of pretty feeble amounts that only get you up to about 3 million degree loops, up to a couple of orders of magnitude more, which give us sort of 13 to 15 million degree loops. And for each group of experiments that we ran, we kept all of the length, the heating, and the timescale parameters the same, but we changed the resolution of the grid. Okay? So for what I call a refinement level of zero, we have 400-kilometer grid cells everywhere along the loop. All right? And then for a refinement level of two, then the adaptive grid routine is allowed to put 100-kilometer grid cells where necessary, or down to 100 kilometers anyway. And then for a refinement level all the way up to 12, then where necessary, the adaptive regridding routine can go down to 98-meter grid cells. Okay, and these can be placed anywhere along the loop. And we did 84 runs in total. So again, we're interested in what you have to do to resolve the field-aligned physics in coronal heating models. All right, so let's have a little look at some results. So this is for the results from group three, which are a reasonably severe case, 0.8 ergs per second going in for 60 seconds in a short loop, getting us up to about 13 million degrees. So if we look at the density first, all I've done is I've calculated the average coronal density as a function of time. And this lower solid line here is the grossly under-resolved case of 400-kilometer grid cells. And then the dotted line is for grid cells of smallest grid cells of 100 kilometers, and so on, so on, so on, up to the most highly resolved case, which are the 98-meter grid cells where needed. And you can see that the solution in this case sort of gradually converges as you get up to higher refinement levels. Okay, but you can see there's a massive difference. Right? If you under-resolve your grid, the first thing you can see is you're not getting is just the material isn't getting up into the corona. And this has a knock-on effect for the temperature profile. If the density is different as the loop starts to cool, then this affects the interplay between thermal conduction and radiation. So the interesting thing is actually the grid, the peak temperature that the loop reaches is actually completely independent of the grid resolution. Okay? It doesn't care what the grid resolution is. And this tells you that the corona by itself is perfectly able to deal with the energy that's going in. And then, of course, you have the average pressure. This is obviously a proportional to the product of density and temperature, so you can see the differences reflected here. And this is also a proxy for the coronal thermal energy. Okay, so it tells you that the amount of energy going up into the corona is being grossly underestimated when you under-resolve your loop. And then the nice little temperature density phase space plot sort of tells you the evolutionary path of the loop, and you can see that's very different. All right, I'm going to skip the next two, but it basically tells you the same story in slightly different conditions. So let's just summarize what we've found so far. So if you under-resolve the transition region, then this gives you a gross underestimate of the coronal density. If you underestimate the coronal density, this has knock-on effects for things like emission measure modeling and spectral modeling. You underestimate the enthalpy flux into the corona, because as all this energy comes barreling down into the transition region, it should be heating and ablating that plasma back up, okay, and that carries with it an enthalpy flux. But if you under-resolve it, then you don't get that return energy flux into the corona, and so you don't deal with energy transport through the sun's atmosphere properly, and of course, most of our missions now are very keen on modeling, on sort of investigating energy transport through the sun's atmosphere, so we need to be able to model it properly as well. Okay, we checked a couple of things. We made sure that under-resolving the grid wasn't just losing energy and material spuriously by violating conservation laws, but the code does a nice job of energy conservation to better than 0.1% for a whole run, so we figure that's not the issue. I've pointed out that the temperature only depends on grid resolution during the cooling phase because of what's gone before, and this is because of the interplay between thermal conduction and radiation, which depends on density. And these findings also show that energy isn't actually bottled up in the corona when the transition region's under-resolved, as has been previously thought, because the under-resolved case is clearly cool more quickly, okay, because thermal conduction is important for longer. So I just want to quickly say what actually happens to that energy. If it all goes down the loop, where does it actually end up if it's not refilling it? Well, I've got a couple of plots here of the for group three, as it's sort of halfway towards being full in the corona, and I've plotted the temperature profiles for three different refinement levels, from grossly under-resolved to well-resolved, and you can see that reflected in the data points here, how far apart how small the grid cells are. So very well-resolved transition region, okay resolved, pathetically resolved. Now this plot shows you the thermal conduction as a function of a spatial coordinate down towards the bottom of the loop. And just focus on this solid line here for the moment. The grid cells are, in this region, this is where the thermal conduction is positive, so it's a source, so it's providing energy. And the solid line here, where there are no data points, this is where thermal conduction is negative, but I wanted to plot it on a log scale, okay, so you can see it. Now, and this is the radiation for the same region. Now, this is the key plot. Here we see this is simply the difference between, this just plots the difference between thermal conduction and radiation, okay? Now, where this quantity is positive, this means there is energy available to heat material and ablate it back up into the corona, okay? And you can see for the grossly under-resolved loop, so here it's a sink, so there's no heating going on here. Now here, there is some heating going on, but it's in a region of the loop where the density is still quite low and the temperature is still sort of around coronal, what we think of as coronal temperatures, okay? And so what we're seeing is that the heating is taking place in the lowest density regions, and that's why the corona is being underfilled. And in the better resolved cases, we can actually see that heating takes place all the way through the steepest part of the transition region where the density jumps up, okay? So there's lots of energy available for heating in the highest density regions of the loop, and that's why they're filled more. All right, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip that. So let's just make a couple of conclusions. So the answer to our first question is, what are the consequences of under-resolving the solar atmosphere in coronal heating models? Is just that you grossly underestimate the coronal density and the upward energy transport. So that leads you to the wrong conclusion concerning the source of coronal plasma, because you just end up neglecting the transition region contribution, and then you get the energy balance wrong. And what can we get away with for particular regimes? Well, we found for quiet sun models, 100 kilometer grid cells are okay for sort of 75% accuracy, 25 kilometers for 90% accuracy. For active regions, we find for 75% accuracy, sort of 6.25 to 25 kilometer grid cells, for 90% accuracy, sort of 1 kilometer up to about 6 kilometer grid cells. And when I say accuracy, I mean to within 90% of the fully converged solution for the highest resolution. And then for flares, sort of all bets are off. I've said below a kilometer, it can go down to meters and centimeters, frankly. So, all right, and what can be done to help mitigate some of these challenges? Well, read my paper, please, or come and grab me. All right, thanks.
So we went over time, so we have only one question. I'll go with Eric.
Superb work, Steve. One big message to me is that one-dimensional models like this, we will always need them, because the three-dimensional models will never have a hope of doing this problem properly. So the 3D and the 1D and the 2D models all complement one another. We need a suite of models, in other words.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, you imagine trying to do something like non-local thermal conduction along every single field line in a 3D model. We are way off that. Even 1D models struggle. So, yeah, thanks.
There's another way to get around this problem, and that is if you modify thermal conduction and your radiative loss function in the low temperature regime, you can broaden your transition region so that you can capture it. The penalty is that whatever temperature you pick, let's say 250,000, then your solutions below that will not be thermally accurate. So if you're interested in coronal lines,